You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Individuals ranging from youthful pranksters to international cyber criminals continuously threaten our personal, organizational, and indeed the security of our nation. This podcast addresses the current status of internet security at all levels, including what you can do better to protect yourself in the digital age. Elaine Chang, who is the Managing Director and Chief Information Officer at CFA Institute, oversees all aspects of information technology globally for the organization. Her primary focus is to provide and support organization-wide IT, including infrastructure and architecture, applications development, business process re-engineering, networks, and computer operations. Eric Rizzut is the Help Desk Manager at UVA's McIntyre School of Commerce and was previously an IT manager at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is a certified information systems security professional with nearly two decades of information technology and information security experience. Ms. Chang and Mr. Rizzut spoke at the Wednesday, October 14, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Rich DeMong. Our podcast is entitled Internet Security. Here's Rich DeMong.
So how many of you knew that October was Cybersecurity Month? The rest of us, okay, we got several folks that knew it. Goodness sakes, I thought it was Halloween, but it turns out it's cybersecurity, and this is a perfectly timed session. Some have argued that the current state of cyber warfare and malicious hacking is so serious that the federal government should launch a project of the scale of the Manhattan Project in World War II to develop the atom bomb. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal had a front-page story entitled Cyber War Ignites New Arms Race, Countries Amass Digital Weapons, Reconfigure Militaries to Meet the Threat. Hundreds of millions of Americans have had their identity stolen, their data stolen by hackers, including 110 million target customers, 21.5 million federal employees who had not only their normal data, but they had all of their preferences stolen from any application that they had for security clearance. Customers at Neiman Marcus, Michael Stores, UPS, Goodwill Industries, Home Depot, Dairy Queen, Kmart, Staples, and many, many other companies have had their customers' data stolen. I don't know why they went after Goodwill Industries, but they did. Sony, as you know, had all of their emails released and had much of their data destroyed by apparently the North Koreans. The Pentagon has hit many times, some of them successfully. The White House got hit, and even the Russians were able to get President Obama's travel schedule and his daily emails. The Senior Statesman of Virginia is pleased to have two folks that have worried about and have been very successful in preventing cybersecurity intrusions at two major institutions, both with a global reach. First up is Elaine Chang, a Managing Director and Chief Information Officer of the CFA Institute. Elaine is accountable for the future vision and strategy of technology and systems at CFA Institute. She has a BA from Vassar College and MBA from the University of Rochester. She will focus on the trends of internet security and protective strategies at an organizational level. The next speaker, Eric Rizzut, will focus on five things that an individual should not do on the internet. Eric is the Help Desk Manager at the McIntyre School of Commerce at the University of Virginia. Prior to coming to UVA, he was the IT Manager at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he's the co-author of 10 Don'ts on Your Digital Devices. We'll raffle off three copies at the end of this meeting for a member of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia at the very end. Please help me welcome Elaine Chang, to talk about internet security. Elaine? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, there it is. Fine. Okay, there we go. All right, and hopefully this is on. Can you all hear me? Is this mic on? Okay, great. Thank you, first of all, for allowing us to come today to speak to you. It's such an honor to be here. Thank you so much. And my mother-in-law's in the audience out there.
Welcome.
And she's the Chang side of Chang. I am not a Chang. You probably picked that up. And I'll try to convince her to become a member after this, Rich. So anyways, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to speak about, let's see if this works. Oh, there we go. I'm going to speak about, as Rich mentioned, security at the organizational level. So what do companies and organizations do to protect your data? What does it mean to you? And then, you know, maybe give some thoughts on what's the government's responsibility. I'll just kind of share some things to think about around that. Before I dig into that, just a little bit about CFA Institute. Many of you may not know CFA Institute. We're an organization that's headquartered here in Charlottesville. We have about 350 employees in Charlottesville. We occupy the old Martha Jefferson Hospital. That's the one way people know us. and we don't do a ton of business in Charlottesville. Most of our customers are across the globe. We're a professional organization that serves individuals in investment management. And so we certainly serve individuals here in Charlottesville that are in investment management. But a lot of our constituents are outside of Charlottesville. However, having said that, we do a lot of programming in Charlottesville for the individuals in our organization. So we bring a lot of money into the community in terms of travel. We have some events every year in the summer where we actually max out every hotel room in Charlottesville. If you're looking for hotels in the beginning of July, you won't find them. But anyways, we're proud to be a member of the Charlottesville community, I'm so happy to be here today. Thank you for letting me be part of this event. So just a little bit about some things that commonly are used for corporate security, and I'm going to explain all of these in a little bit of detail, hopefully. So some things that companies typically do. In general, companies spend about around 6% of the total amount they spend on technology on internet security, on overall technology security, and that's growing. So that continues to increase every year, as you can imagine. And these are some of the things that companies do in order to protect your data. So the first is firewalls. And you can kind of think about a firewall literally as a something that will protect. If you think about an actual two burning buildings that are sitting right next to each other, if you put a big slate of, you know, metal in the middle of them, it would protect one building from the other. Well, that's essentially what firewalls will do. And sometimes there are firewalls that protect you from the outside as a first line of defense. And sometimes companies will even put firewalls within their company so that certain data is more protected than other data. And so firewalls are commonly used, but they're just one line of defense. And in internet security, you need multiple layers of defense, right? If they get through the first door, you want to make sure that they don't get through the next door. If you think about it, if you have, you know, a case of jewels that you're trying to secure, like data, you put it in a chest and you lock that chest, and then you probably put that chest in a safe and you lock that safe, and then you put the safe, you bury it underneath the ground, and then, you know, outside of the building, you put a big wall around it, and then you might dig a moat, and right? So these are all the things that we try to do to keep the, you know, bad people out. And so firewalls are sort of one of the first lines of defense that everybody uses, but usually not the only one, at least at the corporation level. We also have what we do call an internet security DMZs, which you probably heard a little bit about. It's a military term, but it's a demilitarized zone, or, you know, what you might see here in this case, you know, just kind of a space in between, you know, where you might have your, you know, protected information and your other information, just kind of keeping it separate. So again, just another layer of security. And then we also have intrusion protection systems, so other systems in the corporation that are looking to see if anyone has in some way penetrated any of the data or databases. And again, you can kind of think about that like a dog that sniffs your luggage at the airport, you know, looking for drugs, right? So an intrusion protection system would be kind of sniffing to see if something was, in fact, not a normal traffic in your network. So that's another thing that we might use. Let's see if this works. No. Oh, I'm pressing the wrong thing. That's why. Now I think I am pressing the right thing. Oh, there we go. That's how technology works, right? Just try it a couple of times. Eventually it'll work. So this is also, another thing that we use. You guys are probably familiar with identity and access management, which is basically your logins, right? So all those frustrating logins that you have to use and remember and all the crazy codes. Most companies have an identity management solution, and it keeps track of who has access to what and at what level. And you're just making sure that you only have the right access to the right things. So this drives a lot of the security in a lot of systems as well. Some other things that I didn't actually have pictures for that are commonly used are virus scans. So there'll be a lot of scanning. You guys probably have these on your own PCs at home, perhaps. But we'll scan all of our systems, all our applications, all of the computers, individual computers, just to make sure that we don't have malware or viruses on there. We'll also use a lot of encryption, and again, you're probably familiar with that term, so really important data will be encrypted. So if for some reason it is accidentally accessed or maliciously accessed, that it won't be viewable or visible to individuals, so we'll pick certain data to really protect that. And then there's also best practices that we use around coding. So if you're going to create a website, there's some particular techniques that you need to use to make sure that things like passwords and passcodes aren't available or easy to see or anybody can actually get access to. So again, these are layers and layers and layers and layers and layers. I'm not even mentioning there's a few more layers, but I thought that'd be way too much to go into that we use to try to protect data. But the fact of the matter is that I think it's very hard to protect data 100% these days. And most companies have sort of woken up to the realization that they can't protect everything for sure. And that at some point they're going to have some kind of attack that's going to get into the systems. And so the real focus in corporate security these days is fast ability to see when something is in your system and get it out quick, before they actually take data out, before they can cause any damage. So there's a lot of focus on that these days. So it's this response and the ability to respond quickly. And companies aren't really great at this yet, but I think they'll get better and better over the next few years. So just to give you a sense of the types of incidents that we're seeing. Sorry, this is all really small. I'll get into a little bit more of this data in a minute. But there's a report that Verizon puts out every year. You probably mostly know Verizon because of its cell phone service, but they actually have a very large part of their business that is internet security or cybersecurity. And they do a big study every year where they take information from the European Union and from the U.S. government about how many breaches and attacks are reported. And there's, as you can imagine, thousands of these. And they try to categorize what exactly is causing it, where we're seeing increases or decreases. And I thought it might be interesting to see a little bit of this data in terms of what we're seeing. The cost of a cyber attack to a company, the average cost to a company that where there's actually a breach, will be $1.9 million. So it costs about $1.9 million if they actually have a breach. So The little bit that companies are spending on security, they could probably justify spending a little bit more, because if there's actually an incident, it is quite costly to organizations. And that's just the average. In cases that you guys have heard about in the news, like Target and Home Depot and some of those larger breaches, are millions and, you know, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for them to really be able to cover all of the cleanup for those particular incidents. But some common ways that some common breaches that will happen, things to be aware of. This is what's called a point of sale intrusion. So there'll be some type of malware that will be attached to these little swipers where you swipe your cards. And that magnetic strip is easy to pick up data from. That's why a lot of cards, I think this is being enforced sometime in the next couple months, right? Where you need a chip. I mean, that'll get broken eventually, but at any rate, it's a little bit safer. But all the Target incident that you probably heard about in the news was the point of sale system. So, you know, this is a pretty common way to get at these devices. You probably heard of card skimmers. So some individuals will put a skimmer, what they call a skimmer, on like an ATM, and it'll actually view that card as it's going into the ATM. I am, by the way, not trying to scare you. I want to tell you that, particularly with your cards, if your card gets compromised in any way, it's probably something that you're aware of, but I'll just repeat it because it probably bears repeating. If your card gets compromised in any way, you are not liable. So you will not lose anything should somebody take that card and start charging a storm up on it. All you need to do is call your credit card company. Your credit card company is 100% liable for that. Maybe there might be a $50 or something that you might be liable for, but generally speaking, they're 100% liable for anything that happens on that card. So you should feel free to use it in any of these point of sales and any of these ATMs. There's nothing for you to be concerned about. As soon as you see something on your statement that doesn't look like what you've done, you just call and report it and they'll take care of it. It's in their best interest to make sure that you use those cards. They have very sophisticated, as I'm sure you've probably had a call or two, like, hey, were you in Hong Kong this past weekend? They have very sophisticated ways of tracking that. They know they're going to have some fraud. It's just part of the business for them. So at any rate, that's another one, card skimmers. There's a lot of, as I mentioned before, certain websites. A lot of attackers will try to attack a website itself. They'll try to place some kind of code on a website to see if they can pick up information as it's being used on that website. So that's why good coding practices from a lot of sites are important. Let's see. The thing to really be, I think, careful and cautious of when you're, for sure you're going to hear a lot more of this in the second part, but, you know, it's just to be very careful about where you're putting your credentials. You want to make sure that you're at the right site. You know, type it in so that you know you're really at the right place, because a lot of criminals will try to put malicious code on certain websites that look like other sites. So you just want to be very careful about that. And then there's denial of service attacks, which are not that they're not trying to steal data. They're just trying to stop a company from being useful. So they're trying to shut their website down, in which case they're just trying to stop business. So that's not really an issue for the consumers, except that they can't do business. We actually see a lot less of these days than we used to see. This was kind of a very early method of attack, but the criminals have gotten smarter and also realized that this type of attack doesn't give them a lot of money. So they don't do this a lot. Usually this will be activists who are just so against a company, they're just trying to stop its business. There's still out there in terms of physical theft and loss that's associated with first getting information through a cyber attack and then using that information to somehow create a physical attack of some sort. So for example, being really careful about, you know, if you're on Facebook, don't put on there, hey, I'm out of town right now. not a good idea. Don't do that. You know, I think just, thieves are now kind of cued into, we're sharing everything about ourselves online, and you just want to, that can translate into, you know, physical theft. And this happens at the corporate level too. So there's still some internal misuse. So sometimes there are bad actors in an organization, and those are things that we also need to make sure we're being very careful of. So even within your organization, you want to limit access. You want to make sure that only the right people have access. You still want to have some dual controls to make sure that, individuals who have access to sensitive information have some checks on them, so they're not harvesting that information in a way that they could then sell it or use it. So, and then we actually do things to ourselves, and these are called miscellaneous errors. Hopefully not that many. I think you probably hear a lot more too about cyber espionage or nation state espionage. These are attacks by nation states on companies, and this is becoming increasingly, you're seeing a lot more of this. This is particularly hard hitting to manufacturing companies because a lot of these attacks are trying to steal intellectual property, right? Designs for certain equipment. We have an individual that works for us that just left GE, the GE that's here in town. And the amount of attacks against GE is probably more than any other company on the globe, because other companies, but mostly nation states, I will not mention the nation states, but you can probably just fill in the blank for yourself, are trying to steal the designs of companies and then manufacture on their own these knockoffs. And this is actually where the real cost is to companies. So the things that I've been talking about in terms of stealing credit cards and trying to monetize that, those have some cost to companies. I don't want to tell you that they don't, but mostly it's in the form of, working with the credit card companies to stop all those cards and reissue the cards and reimburse the card companies for that. And then sending an email to all of you to say, so sorry, we had this problem. You're going to get a new card. If you're worried about your identity, we're going to give you this identity protection, use it for a year, right? Okay. There's a bunch of costs associated with that. And that might be the $1 million that I mentioned to you, but that is peanuts in terms of what the real worry is for many companies that have any kind of intellectual property or products that could get stolen and reproduced. And again, this is particularly true in manufacturing, a little less in the service industry. Because once intellectual property is stolen, the value of that product that they used to sell now goes down to, a lot less, maybe zero, depending on what that market is. So this is where the real threat is, I think, at the organizational level and at companies. This is what people are really worried about. And when we talk a little bit, as Rich did, about should the government get involved or should we have a big project like the Manhattan Project, this is what we're really talking about. This is the concern. This is the area that we need to protect ourselves against. And to the extent that the government gets involved in that, I think that will be helpful. I don't think that becomes regulation. I think that's more a thinking of an investment around, just like we do arms and military, right? This is kind of the new war out there in certain cases. And I think it would be useful for the government to start thinking about how much of their military or their defense is appropriated to cyber versus, physical defense, because that's really where, I think that's gonna play a big deal. In terms of regulating companies, should you have this level of security or that level of security? I think they'll work through that on their own. They are profitly motivated to make sure that they have enough security to protect you. And most of that is really just a penalty on themselves as opposed to being a real threat to you as an individual. So this just kind of shows you the trends of all of those particular security incidents that I mentioned. So card skimmers, miscellaneous errors, denial of service, cyber espionage. So cyber espionage is still small, but this is also reported reported cases. So sometimes people won't report the cases. So we don't necessarily know if that's growing a lot or not a lot, or if it's even noticed. Some companies are not picking it up yet that they've been attacked. So what you can see here is that, there's definitely some areas that are going down. Some are staying flat. Some are going up. So you can see the point of sale intrusions went down significantly because they're starting to get, smarter about what to protect. Web attacks, again, in the early 2000s, there was a lot of them. People are getting smarter. We're coding smarter. Those are going down. But these will continue to shift, and these are just trends that companies like ours will look at and see, are we doing enough around all of these types of particular incidents to protect ourselves? So I talked a little bit about passwords. I think you'll see a lot more changes related to passwords over time. Passwords and login information is probably the number one way that an individual will get access to a company system. So just having login and password, as you know, it's tough to keep that secure because it's tough for individuals to remember the 15, 20, 100 different passwords you have to make them, secure enough, right? To use all the crazy variations that all these companies like ours want you to use, capital letter, lowercase, put numbers in it, don't put numbers in it, 10, 20, that's a difficult thing for any individual to remember. So I think you're going to start to see, a lot more what they call biometrics being used. So, you're starting to see a little bit with the iPhone that you can now, use your thumbprint as a login to your phone. I think we'll see a lot more of these. This is just a case about a company who not only is using, the thumbprint, but also the actual way you're holding your phone, the natural way that you hold it versus somebody else is being tracked as a way to log in. And so you'll start to see more and more. I know it's crazy, right? But these are the types of things that, you'll start to see unique ways that we can identify you and no one else. And these are probably just all being tested right now, but just some interesting dynamics. This is a huge area of research because I think there's a clear identification that this is a problem and it needs to be resolved. So just on the policy side, I talked a little bit about this, is policy good? Is it not? Again, I think it's probably less about regulation to individual companies. I think that companies are self-motivated to protect themselves. It's very costly for them to have an issue or a breach. And the risk, if you consider where we do have a lot of regulation, financial services is one, I'm probably not going to pick on that. But let's take airlines as an example, right? The reason why airlines have so much regulation for safety reasons is because the risk of something going wrong is so great, right? Risk of life loss. There's no way to compensate anybody for that. In this case, the risk to individuals is not that high. So companies will ensure that that they compensate you for, trouble or lost cards, or, you're not liable for those cards anyway, at any rate. Over time, that may change. I don't want to make a huge statement that those things might shift. But generally speaking, over time, at this point, that risk is pretty small. And companies are very motivated to secure your data. They understand that your trust is only as good as the data that they protect. And that's business for them. So I think that's probably less the area to focus on. But should the government invest in security across the board, making sure that we are protected as a nation, that grids don't get shut down, that, somehow an attack, eliminates electricity I think those are reasonable ways to spend government money and should be invested in. Cause I can guess that other, nation states are in fact investing in those areas. So we would not want to lose that particular war. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it on to here to Eric, who's going to talk to you about your own personal protection, which is probably going to be much more interest to you. But thank you very much for letting me speak today. I'm happy to take questions at the end.
Or questions at the end. So, yeah, hold on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elaine. That was great. And I just want to echo what Elaine had to say, that it's an honor to be here. I'm glad that Rich invited me to speak to you all today. Always happy to talk about cybersecurity. I'm going to apologize once and only once for scaring you, because some of the things will probably scare you. But this kind of training isn't effective if we're all not at least a little bit scared. My talk today is entitled Five Lessons from 10 Don'ts, and this is a book that I wrote last year called 10 Don'ts on Your Digital Devices, and it's designed to, the publisher insisted on using the word non-techie in the title, which I don't love, but it's designed for non-technical people to pick up on ways that they can better protect their data. So officially, here's what the publisher has to say about 10 don'ts, and this is some very dry boilerplate information. In non-technical language and engaging style, 10 don'ts on your digital devices, blah, 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 blah. Here's what 10 don'ts is in actuality. 10 don'ts is goofus and gallant. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Highlights magazine for children that's been around since the 1940s. In 1948, they invented this cartoon strip called Goofus and Gallant that is still in the magazine to this day. My 9-year-old daughter still gets Highlights magazine. And it was a staple of pediatricians' offices when I was growing up. They invented this comic strip to try and teach kids patterns of better behavior. And the best way they found to do that was to create a character that does everything wrong. So Goofus bosses his friends. Then along comes Gallant, who asks, what do you want to do next? This has been proven to be a very effective way of teaching something. Show people what not to do, even if sometimes it's overly obvious. People say, well, I would never do that. I know not to do that. That might be true, but you might reach one or two people that say, well, I might have done that. I can see myself doing that. That was the idea behind this book. And so I wrote it with a good friend of mine who's a business professor at the University of Alabama, and he kind of brought a non-technical perspective to it, if you will. He and I were talking about it, watching our kids play in a swimming pool, and kind of came up with this idea that there are things that technical people are completely aware of that non-technical people never think of. So the book is intended to bridge that gap a little bit, and we invented a goofus for many of these situations. So I'd like to get people to develop what I call reasonable paranoia. And so the definition of a paranoid person thinks everyone is out to get him. Okay, not everyone is out to get your personal data. But there are people out there in the world, bad people, who want to get someone's personal data. It's not necessarily yours. They're out to get whatever data they can find. And we draw some analogies in the book to home security, right? So we all lock our doors when we leave the house in the morning. Many of us have security systems. We do what we can to protect our home, to keep it secure from thieves. If there's some reason that a thief really wants into my house, and my house specifically, he's probably going to find a way to get in. But I don't have to make it easy for him. If he's coming down the street looking for easy marks, I don't want to be that easy mark. And I know this sounds heartless, but I want him to go break into my neighbor's house before he breaks into mine. And I don't really want him to break into my neighbor's house either, but I don't want to be the easiest target on the street, because that's the one that the thieves will victimize. And the same thing is true in the digital world. Don't be the easiest mark. There's always going to be bad guys out there stealing someone's data. Just make sure it's not your data. So these are the 10 chapters in the book, and the ones I've highlighted here in red are the ones that I'm going to talk about today. True to the title of the book, they all start with the word don't. And again, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to teach people what not to do at the beginning of each chapter. And then we segue into, okay, so if you're not doing these things, do these things instead. So the first chapter of the book is Don't Get Phished. And what is phished? Well, even though it's spelled stupidly with a PH, phishing, you can think of as you're sitting in a rowboat fishing. Criminals are out there casting lures into the water, seeing what they can get. They'd like to get a big fish, but sometimes they'll take the little fish, which is you and I, too. So they're trying to get something out there, a link, an attachment. This is almost always through email. There are other forms of phishing as well, but most commonly through email. They're trying to get you to click on something that you shouldn't, by making it look like something that you want to click on or that you should click on. They're disguising something malicious or malevolent as something useful. And so in the early days of phishing, 10, 15 years ago, they were pretty easy to find. Why? Because the grammar would be off, the spelling would be off, the company logos would be horrible, it wouldn't even make any sense. We still see some of these today. So this example I've got up here, this is an email that I received myself actually about 2 weeks ago. It shows it's from Stella McCartney, you know, so the daughter of Beatle Paul McCartney. I didn't even know that she knew me, so that's pretty exciting. And so the English is, you know, mostly right, but not quite right. I hope we could both have an honest conversation about where our path is headed regarding the business proposal I sent your way. Please ensure to refer to the Adobe document that's attached. And then she signs it off, you know, as if she's with a company called Chinese Aviation Fuel. So I'm not particularly interested in Chinese Aviation Fuel. I don't know anyone named Stella McCartney. This is a pretty easy one to ignore. What has happened is that the fishers have gotten smarter. So just like nature builds a better mouse when we build better mice traps, the fishers have realized that they have to find ways, better ways, to trick us all. So they tend to look more like this. If they're trying to send to, and in this case it's a fictitious company called Worldwide Incorporated, if they're trying to trick the employees of Worldwide Incorporated into clicking on a link in an email, they're going to do everything they can to make it look legitimate. They're going to use Worldwide Incorporated's correct logo, and these kind of things are available on the website, so of course they can get a hold of their logo. They're going to probably hire English majors to make sure that the grammar and spelling are correct. They're going to include other legitimate information. So in this sample email, everything may be correct except for the link at the bottom. So the logo is correct. If you click on the logo, it may take you to the legitimate corporate homepage. They've got a phone number extension in here for the corporate help desk. Again, that information is probably publicly available on the web. Most companies don't hide or make their help desk contact information secret. I'm a help desk manager. We don't want that information to be secret. We want people to know how to get in touch with us. So that's probably publicly available. So the fishers can pull all this data together and compose an email like this that looks pretty legitimate. They'll also time it correctly to try and send waves of these emails to corporations that are undergoing some changes, maybe a departmental merger, maybe a separation where two companies are breaking into pieces, maybe a company that's just undergone an overhaul of their IT services. I'm sure that you all heard about UVA's attack over the summer, where UVA's information technology had some malicious actors from China in systems for a while. And our UVA's central IT systems were shut down for a weekend in August. They brought them back up. They flushed the bad guys out. But when the systems came back up, we saw a rash of emails like this. Why? Because bad guys, and probably not the original bad guys, probably other bad guys, saw news releases, saw NBC29 talking about it. Maybe it poked up on CNN or the Washington Post or the New York Times that UVA had this giant cyber attack. And these guys think like, okay, now this is our chance to move in. So these kind of things tend to pop up in the wake of other attacks like that, especially attacks that make the news. So how can you tell? How do you know if this is real or fake? So what I've tried to train my users to do at the School of Commerce and what we talk about in the book is to hover before you click. Put your mouse pointer over a link. Anytime you get a link in an email that somebody's asking you to click, especially if something kind of in the back of your mind for a second says like, I'm not sure this is legit, trust your instincts. If something tickles the back of your brain and says, this looks kind of hokey, there's a reason for that. There's a reason that subconsciously you're thinking that something's wrong there. Hover over the link before you click it and see if it goes where it's supposed to go. In this case, you put the pointer over this link. It says it's going to worldwideincorporated.com. Again, this is a made-up company. You say, okay, that is my workplace. I trust it. If instead you hover over that link and you get something else that kind of wants to look like Worldwide Incorporated, but it's really worldwideincorporated.azz.aaaa.ru, which happens to be Russia's country code, so .ru domains are located in Russia, this is the kind of email that you delete and don't click through. Be suspicious, and again, be reasonably paranoid. When somebody's asking you to click on something or open an attachment, trust your instincts. Passwords. Elaine talked about passwords a little bit, and I think she's absolutely right that passwords as an authentication system have to go away at some point because they're not suitable for what we're doing today. I'm not sure how quickly that's going to happen. But so what you want to avoid is a situation like this, where you've got a post-it note for every system that you log into. You know, post-it note security really isn't security, and I've been guilty of this. We all do it from time to time. This is something that we really want to try to avoid. So passwords work best when they're long, when they're complex, when they're not written down, and when they're not reused. So password length, just as an example, if you have a normal English language keyboard that has 83 characters on it, if you take in lowercase letters, uppercase letters, numbers, and symbols, if you use 8 characters in your password, that gives you 2.2 quadrillion possible combinations. So that's pretty good. Quadrillion is such a big number, I had to look up what this would be. I wasn't even sure. But if you can only add 4 letters to that password and make it a 12-character password, now you're talking about 106 sextillion different combinations of passwords, which again is a number I had to look up. So every little bit helps. We should all be thinking in terms these days less of passwords and more of passphrases. So as an example, if your daughter's name is Sally and her birthday is April 10th, Sally410 is not a fantastic password. If you can take that same logic and stretch it out to a phrase or a sentence, Sally's birthday is April 10, now you've got password length, you've got complexity because you've thrown uppercase letters in there, you've thrown numbers in there, you've thrown an apostrophe in there, and yet it's still pretty easy for the human brain to remember. It's not a collection of random numbers and characters. Oh, I replace every I with an exclamation point, and I think the uppercase O is supposed to be a number 0, but I can't remember. These passwords, to satisfy these complexity requirements, are often difficult for us to remember, which is why we fall back on post-it note security. But do what you can to avoid that. If you need a memory device to help you remember these passwords, and we all often do, instead of using post-it note security, think about something like a password manager. So a password manager is a small piece of software that runs on your computer or on your mobile phone, or on your iPad, where you remember a very strong master password. Now, you should never forget the master password, because then you're going to be in trouble. So you have to have one password that's secure, that's complex, that's kind of permanently stuck in your brain. Maybe you even write that one down and put it in a safe deposit box at the bank, or lock it up in a file cabinet or a strong box at your house, so you have an emergency way to get back to it. The password manager then remembers all of your other passwords for you. So you can use, and security experts will tell you, use a different password for Gmail than you use for Amazon, than you use for eBay, than you use for Target.com, that you use for all these sites. A password manager can make that process much easier. So don't use the same password everywhere. What happens in a lot of these breaches, Target, Home Depot, Anthem Healthcare, etc., is when criminals get hold of a password database, they don't just try those passwords at Home Depot. They try them everywhere else they can think of. They try them at Amazon. They try them at eBay. They try them at BarnesandNoble.com. And most people don't think like, oh, okay, well, Anthem Healthcare got hacked. You know, fine, I'll change my Anthem password. Okay, but is that email account and password the same one that you used on all these other sites? If it is, now it's in the hands of bad guys who might use it for no good. But the most important password device of all that I can give you comes from a movie in the 1980s by Mel Brooks called Spaceballs. I don't know how many of you remember this movie, but it's a parody of the Star Wars trilogy of films, and it stars Brooks himself as well as Dick Van Patten and Rick Moranis, who are in this clip. So don't be this guy.
Five. So the combination is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's the stupidest combination I ever heard in my life. That's the kind of thing an idiot would have on his luggage.
Thank you, Your Highness.
Well, did it work? Where's the key?
It worked, sir. We have the combination.
Great. What's the combination?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage. Prepare Spaceball 1 for immediate departure.
Yes, sir.
And change the combination on my luggage.
So it's a funny clip, and it's a great point. Unfortunately, that is a commonly used password. So this was a list developed by Splash Data of the most commonly used passwords in last year, in the year 2014. And this was compiled out of all the passwords that were obtained by hackers, all the databases that were breached in 2014. And so the 5 most common are in the left-hand column. And so you can see the most common password used is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then, you know, you can make it a little trickier. You can add 7, 8, and 9. Okay, that's not really getting you too far. So please, if you listen to nothing else I say today, if you have any passwords that appear on this list anywhere, please go home and change them, because the bad guys already have these passwords. So chapter 5 of the book is don't look for a free lunch. If something seems too good to be true, it probably is. This is good advice for life, too. Again, you know, kind of use your instincts. And if something tells you, like, hey, this isn't right, you know, don't look for music, software, movies for free. If something's supposed to cost money and somebody's offering to give it to you for free, there's probably something going on. Paid software is not given away for free. If you're doing a trial version, if you're doing streaming music and you've got, you know, an ad supported, so you can stream Pandora Radio for free as long as you listen to their advertisements, you know, every third or fourth song, that's fine. If you're doing a 30-day trial of Apple Music and you download it, you started that from apple.com, that's fine. If you find a website that's promising to give you a piece of software like Adobe Photoshop for free, that's not fine. Adobe doesn't give away their software. And starting in version 8 of Internet Explorer, and other browsers have this protection too, that Microsoft calls theirs the Smart Screen Database. If you browse to a website that you shouldn't, that's in Microsoft's database of bad guy, of malicious databases, you get a warning on a big red screen like this. If you see this kind of warning, shut down what you're doing, close your browser, do something else. This is kind of an indication that you're somewhere that you shouldn't be. Don't be careless with your phone. So we're all carrying our life around on these little devices in our pockets and our purses these days, and it's great, and I don't really want to go back to not having one, but we have to be careful, because what happens when somebody else gets their hands on this device? We're hugely connected. Pew Research found last year that 90% of Americans own a cell phone, 58% own a smartphone. All these numbers have almost surely gone up since 2014. That's the trend in mobile devices. We're not getting less of them. We're getting more of them, and we're getting more attached to them. So we tend to use them for everything. Why? Because they're always with us. So we use them for personal correspondence. We use them to do our banking. We use them to take pictures. You know, a lot of us don't even bother to have separate point-and-shoot cameras anymore. Why? Because the old joke that photographers will say is the best camera in the world is the one that you have with you. So if it's in your pocket, you're going to use your phone for those pictures, which might mean that there are irreplaceable pictures of your kids and grandkids on these devices, in addition to other more private information. So what happens when that device is lost or stolen? Is there a passcode on it, or can a thief just pick it up, slide the little slider to look through it, and say, like, oh, now I have access to this person's entire email? Apple has now, and other manufacturers now, have started adding fingerprint security to the device. What's nice about that is that it can encourage you, you know, on the iPhone at least, on other phones as well, if you use a fingerprint to get into the phone, you also have to have a password or a four-digit code. But if you're using your fingerprint to log in 90% of the time, you can then use a stronger, more difficult password for the 10% of time, like, oh, my fingerprint didn't work, or I just rebooted the phone, I have to type it in. That allows to give another layer of security and a stronger level of security. If it does get lost, is it tracked using what Apple calls Find My iPhone or what Google calls on their phone's device manager? Can you get it back? The value of the device itself. Now, these phones aren't cheap. You know, they cost $300, $400, $500, $600. But the data on the phone might be irreplaceable to where you can't put a price tag on it. If it's pictures that you don't have in any other place, what's the dollar value of pictures of your children or grandchildren? You know, you can't even put a price tag on that. It's outside the scope of a security discussion, but you certainly should be backing up these devices once in a while too, because they are small, they are fragile, and they're easy to lose, and they're easy to steal. It may also be data that somebody could use against you. It may be your banking data. It may be Social Security data. It may be tax information that somebody could go, you know, apply for a mortgage in your name, apply for a credit card in your name. So the devices aren't cheap, but the data is usually even more valuable. And so that leads into, don't forget the physical. So it's great to have, you know, important digital habits. Think about a passcode. Make sure that you have a strong password on your device. And you think, like, okay, well, I'll do that. I have my passcode on my phone. When I'm out in the world, if somebody gets their hands on it, they can't get in. But you can't forget about your devices at home either, because the easiest way for somebody to get at your stuff is to get their hands on your computer. So we all have occasional need to give someone maybe unattended access to our home. Might be a landlord, might be a realtor, might be a cleaning service. We also have people come into our home when we are present, but we don't necessarily follow them around every step of the way. If a pest control technician from Terminix comes to your house for a quarterly pest control service, do you follow him around to every single room? Most of us probably wouldn't. We let him do his thing. We stay in the kitchen. When he's done, he comes back and says, okay, I'm done. I'll see you in 3 months. We say, great. If you have kids or grandkids, you might have a babysitter in your home occasionally. Your kids might bring their friends over. And again, I don't want to make it sound like everyone's a criminal and anyone who steps in your house you should be giving the side eye to and be like, what are you trying to get at? But it only takes one bad guy to cause a lot of problems. And so if any of these folks that I've just mentioned had 5 minutes alone with your computer, with your iPad, what could they get? Could they sit down at your computer? Is there a password on your computer at home, or does it just open up right to the desktop where they could start looking through all your stuff? Are your banking and credit card sites bookmarked in your browser? Mine are. And if somebody pulls up wellsfargo.com on your computer, is the password automatically filled in for them so they can just say, okay, let me go look at your checking account? Could they pick up your iPad, which might be sitting on your coffee table without a passcode, just start reading through your email? It's an unfortunate reality, but in the year 2015, if you have any devices that don't require a password or a passcode when you pick them up, you should change that. Every device, and I know it's an inconvenience, and I know that passwords are a giant pain in the rear end, but every device should have some kind of protection so that in the probably unlikely event that somebody gets their hands on it, they can't just immediately have access to everything stored on that device. If you have a friend or family member spend the night at your house, maybe they ask you for the password to your home Wi-Fi. This is a pretty common request these days. Everybody wants to be on Wi-Fi. Somebody's at your house. Hey, can I get on your Wi-Fi? Sure, no problem. Most of us would say, yeah, absolutely you can. We don't want to think that our friends or family members are up to no good. But all criminals are related to somebody and are presumably friends with some other people. So, you know, the math checks out. So is that the same? If you give them your Wi-Fi password, again, this goes back to password reuse, but is that the same password that you use elsewhere? So if they spend the night at your house, they say, hey, can I have your Wi-Fi password? Yeah, sure you can. After you go to bed that night, they pick up your laptop off the coffee table. Is that same password that got them into your Wi-Fi also get them into your laptop? They happen to notice that the last website you visited was wellsfargo.com. Does that same password get them into your checking and savings and money markets account at wellsfargo.com? It very well could. Just be cognizant of these things. It's a good idea. Security experts would recommend that on your home Wi-Fi, if you're going to be giving that password out to friends and family, use a password that you don't use anywhere else. And this, again, you know, in theory, we should all be using distinct passwords for every single service. I understand that that's not realistic. But your home Wi-Fi is one that probably should have a unique password, especially if you might have people using it. So again, what does reasonable paranoia mean? So it means be cautious. When you're clicking links, when you're clicking an attachment in an email, think about it. If you're skeptical about it, trust your gut. There's probably a reason that you're skeptical about it. If it claims to be from your credit card company, take out your credit card and call the 1-800 number on the back and say, did you send out an email asking me to change your password? They will most likely say, absolutely, we did not. But if there's a legitimate need, they need some information from you, at least you know you're calling Chase. You're not giving your password to some random person who sent you an email. Be smart with your passwords. Don't give them up. Don't write them down if you can avoid it at all. Be suspicious of deals that are too good to be true, because they probably are. Keep track of your mobile device. I didn't mention it, but one of the most common places for phones and iPads, tablet devices to be stolen are at airports. We have to put them through security. So keep an eye on it. Watch it. Make sure that you leave security with the same number of devices that you entered security with. I think it probably goes without saying that the TSA will pay you a visit if you leave your devices unattended in a waiting area. But aside from security reasons, for, you know, national security reasons, for your own personal security, don't leave your devices unattended. These devices are so much more than phones that it sounds discourteous, but you can't really necessarily just let a stranger borrow your phone for a minute. You might be at an airport like, oh, I missed my flight. I don't have my phone. Can I borrow yours to call somebody? If that's not somebody you know, I would suggest you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't let you do that. And that sounds really rude, but in this day and age, if a bad guy gets 1 or 2 minutes alone with your phone, he can do a lot of damage. And then even at home, be aware of the security of your devices. You certainly don't have to go crazy with home security on your devices, but like I said, Every device, even though it's a pain, should have a password on it. That protects you from somebody breaking into your home, a pest control technician, somebody else that just might see your iPad laying on the coffee table and say, huh, I wonder what data I can get at from here. And then, of course, like every other author, I would say, well, if you want to learn more, you should read my book. We, Dan and I are proud of it. We wrote it to give people some insight into what can be very complex scenarios. I like to tell people if they learn one thing from reading the book, then that's great. They've improved their personal security by one behavior change. If they get 10 out of it, that's even better. But even one change is helpful. This is all the information on the book. I'm not going to read all this to you. There is a discount code for the ebook version, the Kindle or Nook or iPad version, and there's some postcards. I think they're on the back table with this discount code on it, so you can save 30% off the ebook if you're interested. So thank you very much.
Eric, thank you. While we're getting the microphones off, I want to tell you, I did read the book, and I did follow your advice. My password is Donald... Daffy, Minnie, Mickey, Minnie, Pluto, Goofy, Huey and Louie, and Richmond. Because you said eight characters in a capital, so I got them all. So the way the Q&A will work is we've got two microphones, one on each side. So if you just raise your hand and I'll recognize you, and then a microphone will be brought to you. So who has a question? There's one right back here.
Hi, I was wondering, what do you do as far as passwords are concerned if you have, say, a durable or general power of attorney who should be aware of your passwords and you don't want to write them down?
So that's a great question. You know, in that kind of situation, that's probably a situation where you have maybe a sealed envelope of passwords in a locked file cabinet or in a strong box or something like that. You know, I'm not going to say that passwords should never be written down because there are scenarios where that might become necessary, but it might want to be, and this sounds a little, you know, a little cloak and dagger kind of, you know, surveillance kind of stuff, but it might be that they're in a sealed envelope with a signature across the flap so that there's a record when that flap is broken. You know, we know that that envelope has been breached and those passwords are now, you know, in somebody else's possession, and then they could be changed. Those passwords could be changed if necessary.
Great question. Let's go to this side first and then we'll come back.
Eric, when you say don't write your passwords down, does that include don't have a spreadsheet on your computer with the passwords in there, and even if it's password protected itself, or, you know, that's my how deep do you have to go?
Well, so that is certainly, you know, everything is levels, right? So that is a much better password system than Post-it notes stuck on the border of your monitor. I worked with a faculty member once at UAB. This was back in the days when we had the old bulky CRT beige monitors. In black Sharpie, he had written all his passwords along the bezel of the monitor. Literally every inch was covered with Sharpie with, you know, various login information. You know, a password-protected spreadsheet, I'll tell you that that's how my mother manages her passwords. And it works pretty well. And she's got a strong password on it, you know, partly due to my encouragement. And that is kind of the free and easy version of a password manager, like I've talked about. So you've basically created your own password manager. Hopefully that Excel spreadsheet has a very strong password on it. Now, Microsoft Office password protection on something like an Excel file is not bulletproof. You know, Office password protection has been cracked, but the average criminal is not going to be able to get into that file.
Two questions. First, how do they steal your credit card numbers from where you swipe your card? How do they steal that?
So typically what happens is they will use a software that they develop themselves and they install it. So the point of sale reader is just a piece of equipment, just like a computer, and it's got its own, you know, software running in it. And they will somehow get into that network. So actually in the Target case, it was a individual who was the equipment manufacturer for their HVAC system, so the air conditioning system, because the air conditioning system was connected to their network. They got in as a HVAC repair person, got into the network, sent a piece of software they developed through the network to the point of sale machines, it sat on those point of sale machines and didn't download all at once, because that is something that you could see from a network perspective. You're like, hey, somebody's taking all this data out. They just did a little bit at a time, and that was imperceptible to the system monitoring. But over about a year, they stole all that equipment. So it's a software that they install on that point of sale reader. And then when you swipe it, it just picks up that information.
Should we use a password to get into our own personal computer every single day?
You should. I mean, ideally, yeah. And, you know, I understand the inconvenience that that brings with it. But ideally, you'd have a password on your home computer, and your home computer, you know, logs itself out or locks the screen after 30 minutes or after an hour or after some set period of inactivity, so that it's just not sitting there waiting for anyone to come down and sit down and gain access to everything.
There's a question in the back.
If your phone is password protected, can emergency personnel get into your ICE information? In other words, you're not able to communicate.
ICE is in case of emergency. Yeah, many right. of us or have
into,
that.
Yeah, into
number.
Your emergency information. Can they get through that protection? If you understand?
I do understand. That's a great question. I know that on the newest iPhones, you can make 911 calls without unlocking the phone. I don't know that emergency contact information.
It is.
But I mean, like, you're out on the street,
right.
You can't communicate. And the emergency personnel arrive. Can they pick up your phone and learn to who should be contacted, other medical information, things of that sort?
We may have an answer here, John. If you can pass the phone right here, fourth row back.
So on the iPhone, you have emergency information that's available from the lock screen, and you're showing it right there?
Yeah, so this is something I just learned just this second, actually.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you for asking that question.
So how does it work?
So if you slide the iPhone over without entering your password, there's a button that says emergency. And when you press emergency, there's two options, emergency call or medical ID.
There you go.
And if you click medical ID, this is what you get. So this has my wife's contact information, as well as my blood type, which I wasn't even aware that the iPhone knew my blood type. So this frightens me a little bit. I must have put this in myself at some point, but I didn't even know that the iPhone was aware of that.
Fantastic. Next question. Oh, we've got a follow-up.
I have no idea how to put a password onto my computer in order to get into it. Is there some guide there?
So there are. It certainly depends on if it's a Windows or a Mac computer and what version of Windows. But in Windows, it's going to be most likely in the Start menu, Control Panel, and then something called either Users or something called Accounts that you set a password on your account that you use.
Thank you.
Sure.
Elaine, in your slides, you had a drug sniffing dog at one point, and that was an intrusion protection something or other. But then you talked about corporations are also trying to spend resources on eradicating viruses that have somehow gotten into the system, right? Now, how can they be more effective than the guard dog-like thing in the first place?
So sometimes you can't tell. So the guard dog's looking for known viruses. So there's security organizations that you buy the software from, and it's probably common to what you guys have too on your own PCs, virus protection software, and that is known viruses that it's searching for and trying to eradicate. So there's some properties that it knows to look for. Right, so drug sniffing dog knows the smell of cocaine or, you know, pot or, right? But if we introduced an entirely new drug that it didn't know the smell of, it just pass right over it, right? So those are called zero-day invasions. And that's the next level. So that's what people are starting to look more for is, can I find these 0 days that maybe are very specific to one organization? So perhaps there's the attacker is actually just trying to go after, let's say, CFA Institute and create something that's just very specific to penetrating us. So that's what we're looking for. And a lot of tactics that are being used for that are to look for anomalous or not regular activity that's happening on these databases so that you can start to pick up patterns of see through, you know, the normal activity of what is not expected on your network and then pull that up.
We need a microphone up here, if you would. No, we need, because this is going to be podcast, so we need microphones.
Like an example for that, because I was going to ask a corollary question. How do you professionals detect that something's gone wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you go about curing it? How do these security people, I mean, how do you write programs that neutralize it?
Yeah, so it's actually... super complicated. It takes a lot of time and energy to do. And as I said, this is actually a space that is growing. It's this after the fact, being able to identify and quickly eradicate is new. So this will continue to develop and grow. But just to answer your question, Anne, essentially what you do is you look at all of the databases that have data in them. And then you track the normal activity. So you write programs that look at normal activity, and you have to understand what that normal activity is. And then you'll see when there's not a normal activity. So maybe, you know, I go in every day and I look at, you know, all of the data that was added yesterday. And that's something normal that I do, and I pull it out and I put in a report. And maybe that's a normal thing that happens on that database. But if for some reason I know I go in 10 times a day, and then all of a sudden, somebody else went in too. Or there's a 11th transaction. Every day I go in 10 times, and then all of a sudden, one day there's an 11th transaction. That would be something that should create some sort of trigger that I should go look at and see, is that a normal activity that 11th time? Did I just make a mistake and like, yep, I had to go in another time today? Or is it actually something that... is malicious, and then we need to take it out. And the way that you eradicate it can vary depending on what the actual activity is. If it was a piece of malware, what we call, you know, bad software that was installed, like I explained with the POS software, the point of sale software, then you can eliminate that. But you also have to figure out at any point in time, was data taken out? Who was impacted by that data taken out? Is it individual consumers? Is it just your own, you know, data? And then you have to have a plan for that. So it can get quite involved. Sometimes you have to completely eliminate a big server or piece of equipment. You have to replace it. You have to swipe it. So that's where all that cost comes from, is trying to clean it up, and it is quite involved.
There's one other thing about physical that you didn't mention that's dirt simple.
Tell me.
And that is in your home computer, when you're not using it, you first log out, and secondly, turn it off at night or when you are done. There are thousands of attacks per hour.
Wow.
That come across the internet to your Wi-Fi, looking for ports, looking for all kinds of things. And if the damn thing's off... it's hard. But if you're not using it, turn it off. Certainly log off.
That's wonderful advice. There's a question right in front, and then we'll come back over the side.
Yes, I took advantage of getting ahead of time a charge card with a pin on it. Mm-hmm. But I understand now that we're changing that here in the States. Mm-hmm. But we have decided that's too much trouble, so we're just going to stick with the signature. Why? Why don't we go all the way?
Because, again, credit cards don't... The credit card companies want you to use your credit cards. They want you to buy and shop, and they will handle the fraud. They have signed up for that. It's part of doing business, and they've probably looked at the statistics and said, we're perfectly comfortable that people, it's easier for people to just sign, and if that's how they feel, that's fine. So it's really just a business decision that they've made. And they make it because they're perfectly comfortable with whatever that loss is going to be to them, right? Not to you. But it's not to you, because you will... because they will just delete those transactions off your credit card, right? If it's fraudulent and you call in and you claim, this is all in your terms of use with your credit card company. And if you want to read it, go right ahead. But they are 100% liable for that. So it's just the business decision that they've made.
And there's a question in the back, and then we'll come up front again. But all the way back.
How safe is it doing using the cloud and also syncing your equipment?
So cloud security actually has come a tremendous way in the last probably 4 or 5 years. And depending on the cloud company, so I mean, I don't want to blanket that all cloud companies have the same level of security, but more mature companies, you know, if you take sort of some of the big ones like, you know, Amazon Web Services or Microsoft, those cloud companies have very tight security. It will be much tighter than your home PC. So I think you can be pretty comfortable with that. I would be a little bit more cautious if you don't know the company. I would, or you've never heard of it, then you may want to be a little leery of that. But cloud security is has come a long way, and it, again, it's much more secure than what you can secure your own equipment with.
Question up front.
What about when you your account maybe is wiped out, your checking or savings account, through fraud? Is the bank just as liberal as far as redepositing your money without you having to prove anything?
Well, they're going to look at the access history, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think if they find that it is a fault of their own security or not being able to secure the systems, then, you know, they're going to make sure that you're made whole for that. But they are going to look at what happened in terms of the transactions to that account, right? Because there's a lot of fraud that happens in certain cases that aren't related to the security of that platform, right? So it may be that, you know, you did, you know, one of the biggest, unfortunately, and I used to work for a financial services company, so I have a little bit of experience in this, but the number one fraud comes from friends and family. So that, you know, you just need to be very careful. I'm sure none of you or none of your, you know, friends and family, but in a lot of cases it happens where it's a niece or a nephew who has a drug problem or something like that and is looking for money. And so they will, and I think this goes back to a lot of the comments that Eric makes, and I'm sure he's not pointing out anybody in this room or your nieces and nephews or what, or uncles or cousins or whatever, but that is the number one way that money is stolen out of a bank account. So when we're talking about securing your devices at home, Eric's so nice. He's like, it's the, you know, it's watch out. It might be the people coming in to clean your house. No, really, you got to watch your family. And I'm sorry, that's true.
It is true.
But that's where you really need to watch. Yes, you should watch all those other people too. But honestly, just from my own experience and seeing all the fraud cases that I used to see at the financial institution that I used to work for, that is where it all happens. So you want to watch your passcodes. You want to not keep, right? You give them the passcode to your, yeah, you can get on the Wi-Fi. And then they go upstairs and they get on your PC and they look and see if you have your bank account open. They look in your bank account. They send themselves a check out of your bank account. So just that's the kind of stuff that a bank will look at. If they see that happening, they're probably not going to reimburse you for that. But if it's a true fraud issue in terms of external, you know, something like that, so they would.
Another question here.
Thank you to both of you for the great presentations. It's been very, very helpful and very informative. One of you represents a corporation, the other a public university, and it's very common in both institutions to have internal auditors, mm-hmm. internal auditors that go around and carefully look at the books and everything you do. Mm-hmm. In the past 15 years, I've been part of the UVA faculty. I could go down the hall of the particular school, and every single thing that you recommended is being violated just openly. Just openly. Passwords are, quite frankly, a joke at UVA as a whole. Computers are left on all the time. They're not shut down. Passwords are all over. I mean, every single thing you talked about. And so I wonder how you feel both as a corporation, mm-hmm. as a public university. How do you do an audit function so that, you know, you close this? Because it's one thing to teach us about it, but yet I bet in your corporation, and I know in your public university, quite frankly, the violations of this are just rampant. And we know that more than half of of the problems are caused by individual users,
yeah,
as opposed to bad guys from the outside, you know, easily getting in. So I wonder what your comments about, you know, how are you going to close this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, how are you going to close this gap of individual users just disregarding everything that you teach?
Good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. I mean, I think there's a couple things to that, which is it's not going to be perfect. I mean, there's a lot of things that we do to try to prevent that behavior as much as possible. So we force password resets. We force the computers to log themselves out. You know, if you're idle for 15 minutes in our organization, it logs you out. If you have to change your password every 90 days, we force you to do it. You can't use the last one you used. We can, you know, right? Like, so there's a bunch of things that we try to do to close that out. We do have audits. We do have audits to look at the security. It's probably not ever going to be 100% foolproof, but part of what we do is we ensure that not everybody has access to everything because of that fact. So only certain people are allowed to have access to certain critical data and information, and those people have a lot more training and are a lot more sensitized to what they need to do in terms of their... And some of those people also have... We have something called, which neither one of us got into today, two-factor authentication. So that requires not only a password and a passcode, but something else that's physical and probably changes on a regular basis. So just-in-time information, a code that gets sent to you or something like that for that type of login.
Yeah, and from the university perspective, you know, the joke has always been that universities were the Wild West of security, right? Anything goes. Part of that is historical. Universities were designed and are designed to share data, to be open. The reason that the first universities, you know, jumped on what was the fledgling internet was to be able to share data with other researchers. So there's a culture of openness that universities are always going to lean towards, as opposed to the corporate world where the first instinct is to lock everything down. I think in the academic world, the first instinct is to open everything up and then close what we need to close. But universities are being forced to deal with it. We have data that bad guys want to steal. I mean, that's obvious. We have data that other universities want to steal. We have grant data that maybe another institution could use to their benefit. So we're starting to see some corporate policies seep in, things like two-factor authentication, like Elaine mentioned. Just to talk about UVA specifically, we have a separate sort of segmented network that UVA calls the More Secure Network that our financial personnel use, that people dealing with student data, you know, things like Social Security numbers and other kind of federally protected student data, that they have a small token, what's called an iKey, that they have to use in conjunction with their password to gain access to that network. You can't get in with one or the other. You have to have both. So this is a constant battle for universities, and at UVA and elsewhere, we do things that, you know, that make my equivalents on the corporate side weep, because we're not, I don't know that universities are ever in information security going to be at the level where the corporate world is. And I don't know that we want or need to be, but we certainly need to be better than where we are now.
But just following the last question, Eric, so comment on the recent security breaches of the UVA system.
Yeah, and so so understand that I don't speak for the University Information Technology Services. I'm an end user, basically, in that respect. I found out about it at 5 o'clock that Friday afternoon, just like everybody else did. But my understanding was that these were some bad guys that had been in the network for quite a while, and the reason that they were detected was because of the amount of data that they were sending out. So, you know, Elaine was talking about detection. One of the ways that you can detect is when they start sending that data back out, what's called exfiltration. And I just had somebody tell me a couple weeks ago, it's not truly a breach until they start sending data back out. Yeah, they can get in and they can look around and they can look at some stuff, but when they start sending it back home to their servers, that's when they're going to start doing things with that data. And so that has force some changes at UVA in terms of how central passwords are managed, in terms of password expiration. There were some faculty members that hadn't changed a password in 15 or 20 years. And so, you know, those things, when I was previously at UAB, we had a similar situation that kind of forced their hands on that a little bit. That's unfortunate, but sometimes it takes an event like that to bring change.
So one more question here, and then I'll ask the final one.
I think I'm talking into this.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
You get unsolicited emails on a daily basis from hair product companies and ink providers, that kind of thing.
is it safe to unsubscribe to those sites, or do you have to repeatedly, day after day after day, just delete them?
You know, that's it's a little bit of a gray area, because the bad guys that are not following the federal law about unsolicited mail will include a link at the bottom that maybe claims to be an unsubscribe link, but in fact isn't. So I, you know, my kind of personal rule of thumb is that if it's a company that I've heard of, I feel pretty good about clicking the unsubscribe link. If it's something that I have no idea who they are, I delete that email without clicking anything anywhere in that email.
And isn't true most of the email systems have a way of flagging those, so they automatically go to junk file?
That's right. And so you can mark it as spam in your own Gmail or Outlook or Hotmail, and that's completely safe because that's not based on any links in that email.
And you can also call the company and tell them to unsubscribe you. So there's multiple ways to get yourself unsubscribed from an email.
Mm-hmm. So this has been fantastic. You've given us things to worry about and protective strategies as well as things that we can do to avoid internet problems. But I want to ask you to do a little bit of priority. What are the things that keep you up at night personally, starting with Elaine and then Eric? I mean, what should we stay up at night worrying about?
Well, the things that are going to keep me up are going to be different than what keeps you up. So I yeah, so I'm, for me, it's just how fast things are changing and you know, what we need to do to change with them and just keeping up with that. But for you, I would say, I would just stay educated, because the same thing's true just on a personal level, right? So coming to something like this, keep doing that, because this is where you're going to learn, you know, read books like Eric's, read an article about, you know, how to protect yourself. Just stay educated. I think when you stay educated, you stay one step. You're the house that doesn't get broken into. So, you know, as long as you do that, you're going to be in really good shape.
You know, I think for me, I think passwords and mobile devices are the biggest thing. Again, like I said, we're all carrying our lives around in our pocket these days. And if that data gets breached, we could be in real trouble. So I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I'm trying to get her to learn passwords, to learn internet security. You know, she has an iPod Touch that she uses to play games and stuff. It has a password, because there's not going to be a device in my house that doesn't have a password, period, end of story. She is in fourth grade, so they're using computing devices at school. They're using Chromebooks for math practice and social studies practice and writing stories, and they're assigned random, you know, difficult to guess passwords, which I think is great. But how does she bring it home? She brings it home on a Post-it note, and then she wants to refer back to it. And so I tell her, I say, you know, Sophie, like, you can memorize that password. Yes, I know 8 or 10 characters, and they have numbers and symbols, and it's kind of difficult. It's difficult when it's an automatically generated password that you didn't pick yourself. You have to memorize somebody else's random nonsense. But I'm trying to train her, because that's something that's going to, you know, until the point we move past passwords as an authentication mechanism, that's not a skill that she's going to need to use. So what I would say to all of you is that be careful with your passwords, because it's so tempting to either skip them altogether, to use your first name as a password, to use, you know, your street address or maybe your year of birth as your 4-digit PIN code on your phone. Those are the first things that a bad guy's going to try if he gets a hold of your phone. So try to put yourself in the shoes, if you could, of somebody looking to be malicious, and think like, okay, if so-and-so got a hold of my phone, a bad guy got a hold of my phone, what are the first couple digits he might try? Well, if he found it in my front yard, he might look at my mailbox and try my address, right? So maybe I shouldn't use that one.
I want to thank Elaine and Eric for a fantastic presentation to give us some information.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.